But the thing is that these careers are well paid. I'm going to tell you right now that on average, a well-educated, trained mechatronics student, I'll hire him for $60,000 starting right now. You know, want somebody that wants to
that's
learn.
That's not bad. Not bad at all.
What, you know, somebody that wants to learn right now. Somebody that's trained, the top techs that I have, they could be pulling $120,000, $130,000 a year.
The answer to last episode's trivia question is, well, it's really hard to say, but one man, it could be a month.
Hey guys, we'll get into the podcast in just a second. However, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I've updated this older podcast with this announcement from November 2019. I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show. Today, I have Manny Pasillas as the guest of honor. Manny is the owner of Tech CNC, a company specializing in the repair of CNC machines. Manny, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you for having me, John.
Well, you're absolutely welcome. Manny, to get started, let's go ahead and just let's tell everyone exactly what it is that you do.
Well, what we do here at TechCNC is basically go out there to what we call the battleground in manufacturing. CNC machines are computer numerical control machines, and whenever they're not actually producing, you know, usually every company has their own techs and engineers that try to fix their machines, and sometimes it becomes to the point that it's a problem that they got to call us for. So that's where we go. We just, when they're not working, we try to make them work. That's our business.
So you talk about this is a little bit more of a severe problem is when they call you. What would be an example of like something that you've repaired that the particular company wasn't able to resolve, but you were?
Such as the machine, basically, there's a control on the machine and you could diagnose through, its own self-diagnostic tools. It'll give you an alarm, tell you basically where the fault may be, but these are sometimes generalized because these systems contain many different, switches, sensors, and they may be related to the same, source of, say voltage. So they can kind of get an idea, but the system that the machine has, it just generalized. So they get as far as to, okay, it might be this or that. So what we do is we go and dissect the actual machine and figure out which one of the, you know, 20, 30, 100 plus switches is actually giving the fault. That's what we go more in depth and into the architecture of the machine.
And so if it's something that they were able to fix, what kind of things are they able to fix themselves usually?
Usually it's like the obvious, like it'll say there's a over-travel limit switch that's being activated. Over-travel is like the distance from the axis of the machine that goes as a positive or a negative. And if they see that the machine is not really at an over-travel state, you know, it pretty much means that switch may be shorting or faulting. Or sticking. Sometimes, you know, due to the lack of preventive maintenance, you know, there may be some coolant that these machines use. It may get in there and short it out. And so stuff like that's a little bit more obvious, but, you know, there is good techs out there. These companies hire, but sometimes it gets to the point that they just can't resolve it.
Would it be fair to say that you see a wider diverse, a wider assortment of problems and a more recurring number of problems than the average in-house tech would?
Yeah. And John, what we see is what I call like the good ones, you know. The good ones means we get there after all their guys have been through it, after they called all their sources to help them over the phone, after they Googled and YouTubed and all that good stuff. I mean, we didn't have those Googles and YouTubes back in the day, but you know, they do come in handy. But the thing is that when we get there, we get to the good ones. We get to the ones that's like, wow, these guys are on there maybe a day or 2 days trying to figure it out, because they do have their own, you know, maintenance departments. At least most people do. And when we get in there, it's really like the last option, because they really don't want to call outside service to come in, you know, help them out. But what we do, at least in Texas and C, what we do is we educate them. I used to say, you know what, bring me your maintenance guy. Let him work with me. I'll teach him what I'm doing. It's not about not sharing the knowledge, you know, it's being able to help them, because most of these companies have 40, 50 machines. They're still going to call you back if you know, if you're fair and you treat your business with integrity, you know?
Right.
It's pretty cool. Cause sometimes I say, hey, I hope I never see you again. Like when I leave, you know, and some people take it like bad. They're like, what do you mean?
Right.
And I mean that, you know, that means no news is good news. That means you guys are producing, and that's what we want. Let them produce and, you know, be successful, buy more machines, and they'll call us back again, hopefully, you know?
Okay. And so how did this particular skill, this particular service that you provide, how did you get to the point where you're able to do this?
It's pretty like a full circle thing. Prior to any of this situation, I was a young kid. My brother-in-law was involved in the automotive competition and sounds and all kinds of different, you know, the car shows, right?
Right.
And I tagged along. I was a kid. I was 13, 14. And he would hook up these $10,000, $20,000 sound systems in these vehicles. And I was there. It was cool. You know, it was a thing that was cool to me. And to me, it was not anything like engineering. It was just something that was cool. But I learned how to hook up systems with 4, 5, 6, 8 speakers, different amplifiers, crossovers, capacitors, and audio controls. And you know, frequencies and electronics and hooking up batteries in series. All this stuff became something that I wanted to learn because it was fun. So after high school, my dad said, hey, you got to figure it out. So I did a mechanical engineering, took some minors in electrical, and ended up basically working for a company making product and using these machines that started learning programming. And it just took off after there because one of the end users that was selling us the machines, he saw my skill, you know, luckily that I was programming and had some college behind me, and offered me a job. And it was pretty much, you know, I fell back in love into this situation because everything I did as a kid growing up as a hobby was basically what it was for a job. And it was nice. That's basically how I got back into it. And when you can do something you love, like really it sounds, you know, the whole corny analogy, but when you do something that you love, I mean, it ain't work anymore.
That's not corny. That is true.
Yeah, it is. It is beautiful. Put it that way. But I think the best I got out of it was every position I held after that, I excelled because of the way I approached it. And I became an application engineer, trainer, service technician, trainer. So basically the trainer part is me teaching others how to do this. And believe me, when you teach, you're not the only one learning, you know? I mean, sorry, they're not the only one learning. You're actually learning at the same time.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Now, did you teach how to repair, or did you teach how to code, or both?
Both. I was an application and service engineer for a couple companies. And so, what that meant is that most companies have a guy that go set up a machine, and then the application guy comes in and teaches them how to run it. But with my background, I was able to basically kill two birds with one stone. And I'll go in there doing setup and installation. If the company had a guy available, I'd have him help me. You know, it kind of was like one of those things. So he helped me, I helped them. And it worked out cool because if in the future they had issues, I would point out certain areas of the machine, how the machine worked, you know, different mechanicals and electricals in there. So it was easier because I did a lot of traveling. So a lot of times I traveled, you know, figure out everything I could over the phone because one, obviously I have a family. I don't want to travel that much. But two, they save money. You know, if I could do anything over the phone, that was the best.
Right.
But yeah, it was great to teach them.
And so how many years did you work for this particular company, the first guy?
Oh, and there was the first guy. Let me see. That was Precision Twist Drill. If I could put that out there, advertising, right? But anyways, 3.5 years. After that, I went to another company, Advent Tool and Manufacturing, where it was a small outfit. And that's really where I learned how to program. I learned how to do G-code straight programming. And we're talking about 5-axis machines, which is like, I think the maximum you could get out there in terms of programming. But I was there 3.5 years. After that, I went to India. I went on a consulting trip to India for almost a year. Bangalore, India was awesome and beautiful. There, basically, I was a manufacturing and engineering manager of a tool cutter grinder company. They made a lot of tools for different companies out there. And I was like the second in charge below the CEO. And it was interesting because anything from production to engineering to just dealing with the people was my job. And I think these opportunities that I got were great because I was able to understand the business and directly with the owners. More than anything, that was the experience that I think I grasped the most because the technical aspects you can always learn. The people skills, the business side, that's something that you got to be really like rubbing shoulders with people, I believe, to learn. You know, you see the obstacles and you see them overcome them and you just assimilate and take what you learned there.
It's another skill.
Yeah, that's another skill in itself that it's the person, you know, like the personality, the psychology of it. It's not really taught. It's something you have to acquire.
I agree.
There was a lot of other companies I went to and worked for. And I think that's where our niche became because I learned different systems and architectures of different manufacturers, you know.
How many different types of equipment, I don't know, just roughly, are you capable of working on?
I say proficiently, anything that is Fanuc based, Heidenhain, it's a German, Fanuc is Japanese, Haas is American, it's here, and Mazak, which is Mitsubishi controls, them are the top ones I deal with, but then again, these all are basically familiar in the term of logic and diagnostics. Right. You just got to learn how they did it. I've done stuff such as favors. You know, I go to a company and like, hey, well, can you check this one out? And sometimes, you know, I just tell them realistically, I've never worked on that, but you got a set of prints and a couple of manuals. I'll figure it out. And we do call, you know, like the OEM and say, hey, I got this alarm. And sometimes we don't know it all. You gotta be that person. Say, hey, I'm stumped.
Right.
But you know.
But the thing is, you understand the troubleshooting skills. You understand how the machine works. It may not be directly familiar that you've worked on, but the logic and the processes, that's just the way it is. It's just straightforward.
Yeah, troubleshooting has a methodology that you have to follow. Everybody may have their own system or way, but it's solving a problem, you know, it's like a mathematical problem. You have to follow these certain steps to get the answer, right?
Right.
And if you approach every problem in the same way, even when you have to call a friend, you know, you're always going to get to the end result, but you just have to understand the methodology to solve the problem.
Right.
And I think that's what's key with troubleshooting anything in the world.
In my opinion, I've never worked on CNC machines, but it's just a process of elimination.
Yes, that's you're absolutely right, John.
You want it to be targeted, but you're still just saying, okay, you're starting out here and you're just tightening that noose until you zero in on that one little spot where it has to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then sometimes a problem you got today, you may relate it to a problem you got months ago. But at the end of the day, the root cause may be something totally different. But, you know, I keep journals. I keep notes. A lot of people these days have lost the value of what a pen and pencil are. You know, put pen and pencil to paper. And sometimes you go back and say, oh, well, you know, 2-3 months ago, I did this or last year. And I write my notes down. You know, I check these outputs or these inputs, and you know, I change these parameters, and it worked out. So we do go back, and you know, we gotta try different methods of troubleshooting, and sometimes you get lucky. That's what we say in the field, you know.
You've worked for these different companies, you've developed a skill set, and now you've started your own company. How is it that you have made that transition? How did this company come to be?
Well, I got away from this industry for a couple of years. I just wanted to try something different. You know, I kind of rode off the industry for a while, and it always brought me back to this because I'm very analytical and technical, and there's nothing that can give me this challenge. So me and a friend back in Chicago started a business. He was still working for an outfit, and I was out running around on the field, you know, picking up the customers. And it got to a point where we both separated. You know, he just wanted to be more of a employee type of person. If people in business understand that, he didn't want to put the extra hours and you know, what it takes to build a business.
Right.
So what I did, I came out here. I'm originally out of Chicago, but I came out of Houston on a contract, and I saw the opportunities were much greater in terms of, it was just, you know, the oil industry is bustling over here. And I come from aerospace and agriculture, which is like Caterpillar, John Deere.
Right.
But I brought all of that with me. And when I came out here, I said, you know what? Let me start something on my own, with my own principles, my own ethics. And, you know, basically my boss is my wife. You know, she fires me every day, but you know, we sometimes fight for the employee of the month parking lot too. But, you know, we started to do a structure that with everything that I've learned from every other of the companies I worked for, which, you know, I've learned a great, great bunch, and they're all good companies. But I wanted to do it myself, my way, you know, because we can now go into a company and work on their FANUC, work on their Haas, work on their Mazak, you know, work on their Heidenheim. And these companies were previously calling 4 or 5 techs from different parts of the country, which is expensive. Just to get them in there is a couple thousand, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's where I saw the, you know, I guess the good part of what I'm doing is to help people, because in any business, if you can help others, you know, that's the root of your business. You can't be out there for the money, because people that do that, you know, soon find out that's not what they're really trying to do.
Right.
But the business started because of that. It just started because of trying to help people. You know, I consider myself such as a doctor to a human being, right? But, you know, I'm fixing machines. I'm helping these clients get their machines going back up, producing. It's some of these guys are 1-2 machines only. I've worked for companies that are 500 machines, you know? So, you know, the little guys, they'll hurt, you know, their machine doesn't work. They're not making money. Their employees are sitting around, they're paying them for, you know, unproductive time. And it feels good. It's to me, it's more of a service. It's not like a business, you know?
Right. Now the companies, do they typically, like, will one company typically stick with one manufacturer? Do they mix and match?
Unfortunately, John, that's a good question. Unfortunately, a lot of companies do mix and match, which is a very, I guess it's like a downfall to many, because you have cross training in terms of operators. You can't just hire one guy and say, okay, if we run this one and run that one, because he may not know the controls, the programming logic on one machine to another. And that is a downfall, because cross training is key, and many of these companies have no time for that. But yeah, there is companies that have various different types of controls, but at the same time, that's where we come in. We're able to help them, at least on the service side. You don't have to call 3 guys to go fix all their machines, you know. They could just call our company, and you know, my employees, I take 6-7 months to hire them, because I'm looking for that guy that can do more than one thing, you know?
Right. And if he doesn't have
particular set of skills, you want to make sure that he can be the type of person that can quickly adapt and learn those.
Yeah, John. As a matter of fact, I never worked for Haas. I didn't work on him much, but I've become pretty good with him. But then again, I believe in sharing. I believe in knowledge sharing, because that's one thing in life that you can always share and still keep, you know. And I hired one of my employees out of Louisiana, which is one of four in the nation that, or the world, for say, that has gotten an award from Haas. And he is actually training me on excelling, mm-hmm. right? So the thing is that a smart thing I learned was, if you don't know it, hire somebody that does. And, you know, we cross train. I'm teaching him the Fanex side. He rides with me every day. I may break even on a job, you know, just because of the labor expense and all that. But the thing is that I'm making on the knowledge sharing. If I could build this guy up to do two or three different things within 6 months, I think we're all winners. But the customer is the winner at the end of the day, you know.
I can see that, because let's just say it's a shop that's got two, three, four different kinds of equipment. You can come in, first off, you're local, and now you've come in and you've maybe able to address several different problems that they have all at once. Mm-hmm. One of the things you said earlier.
Yeah, absolutely right.
One of the things you said earlier that I was curious about is that because of the oil and gas, there's more opportunity down there. What is it that the oil and gas industry needs that you're producing that is being produced down there that is so prevalent with the oil and gas industry?
There's a lot of flange companies, a lot of pipe companies threading, you know, making connections. There's millions of, you know, linear feet of pipe going in right now. Every rig that's put up, you know, they drill down and they're drilling for miles. So there's a bunch of tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3 companies that are just producing and subcontracting for all the big names out there, you know, your Halliburton's, your Schlumberger's, your Ramco's. And so what we do is we service the companies from the mom and pop shops to the big guys, and we just keep them going. It's just hustling and bustling right now. But the thing is, I don't put all my eggs in that basket. You know, I'm in aerospace. I'm in the gas portion of it, which, you know, refineries. And refineries, they also do chemicals. They're not all into gasoline. You know, you're producing plastics, chemicals, and you got to diversify yourself too. So I'm trying to be a little smart about it, because oil is very versatile. You know, volatile. So you kind of got to spread it out a little bit.
Okay. I guess I didn't realize that all of those things were produced on CNC machines. I guess I just assumed it was a little bit more of a, I don't know, just kind of a different process. And are those parts that are like threaded, do they start with a part that is, say, roughly drop forged or something, and then they just clean it up and put the threading on, or are they milling this from a whole block of some kind of stock?
It depends on the end product, such as if it's a manifold, obviously it's a block that you drill and mill out, you know, the dimensions. It could be cold rolled. It could be extruded. You got pipe, you know, it's not a solid, right?
Right.
And like on the pipe, basically the CNC just takes care of the threading portion, you know, and cutting to size. But there's the majority of everything out there, even the molds that go into this extrusion, are made by a CNC machine. Apple has a plant out there in Arizona that's now the prototype design just alone for their cell phones, you know?
Like the aluminum cases?
They're doing their molds and for other prototype design for other new phones.
Okay.
And the reason they have it in Arizona is because they're actually like basically online or over the phone and over cameras. They have a guy out there because of the sensitivity of these machines. They're very high precision. And in California, there's, you know, earthquakes, right? What was happening is you have earthquakes. They shake the floor and the machine goes out of level. So now you're not actually perpendicular and parallel to the axis of travel on these machines.
So we're talking a high, 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 high level of precision then.
Yeah. We're talking like where I came out of aerospace, and automotive and agriculture, you're talking about tenths, you know, tenths of an inch are your tolerances, you know, cutting tools. You're producing a cutting tool that's a half an inch, drill, right? You're going to make a hole half an inch diameter.
Right.
Well, that drill has to be a half an inch. It can't be half an inch plus or minus a couple of thousandths, which is already a lot. And a couple of thousandths is not much. To bring you into perspective, John, an average human hair might be about 10 to 14 thousandths thick. You know, that's already 14 times above my tolerance on almost every part out there. It's, yeah, very high precision. It's just amazing, the tolerance, the size of things, you know?
That is fascinating. I guess that I'd, you know, I know that like the tolerances, like a, let's say the crankshaft main bearings, I know are pretty precise. And the difference of you have to use things to measure that because it looks okay. And you can't really tell the difference between something that's intolerance or out of tolerance. You have to mic it. That's the only way you can tell.
Yeah. Yeah. And even within the bearing, you have your tolerances there itself. What type of precision you're going to want. You know, you got your P4 tolerances that go to these milling spindles, the spindle which holds a tool that mills the parts out. You know, P4 tolerance is pretty much the max on a bearing. You know, that bearing cannot move. And you're expecting that bearing to rotate up to 12, 20,000 RPMs without it moving even a couple tenths. Yeah, we're working with high tolerances. And this product is not cheap, but it does pay itself back if used properly. I just tell that to all the customers, you know.
I want to go back just for a second. You were talking about the gas and oil industry, and we were talking about the threading on the pipe. Mm-hmm. Are we talking, you know, a lot of the things that I've seen with CNC machines is always like enclosed, but if you're threading a pipe, are we now talking about threading a piece of pipe that could be 20 feet long?
Yeah, I see that on a regular, and it's kind of scary. I'm going to just tell you that you got to be very careful walking around these plants because you have a machine spinning, and you got maybe 20, 30 feet hanging off the other end, and it's spinning. You know, they go about 200, 300, 400, 500 RPM. It's not fast compared to making smaller product, but yeah, they're out there, and you gotta just be aware. And it is what it is. I mean, there's no way else to do it.
So if you're in Houston, I'm sure you've heard how blazing hot the economy is with the gas in West Texas.
Yes, the Permian Basin.
So is that also an industry or an area that the CNC is going to be hot, or is it a little bit different?
As a matter of fact, I'm kind of speculating. Right now I'm building my business here in Houston as a base. And the thing is that I am looking towards the future to hire people and kind of make an auxiliary office out towards the west because there's a large need. The thing is people go where the oil's at. Okay, that doesn't mean that's where infrastructure, services, homes, and all that is at. You know what I mean? It's
right.
It's a hot area, and it's booming right now. The only bottleneck is transportation, you know, of the oil out towards here. But there's that pipeline coming in right now, and right. And right now I'm focusing on Houston. But good thing you brought that up, John. It is an area, Odessa, Midland, that is going to pick up, and a need is there. You know, I'm actually looking for people that are out there in that area to hire and to kind of help me grow the business out there because the need is there. You know, you can't bring all that equipment this way and that way. It's not efficient. So yeah, you're absolutely right, John.
And how many years do you think the Permian is going to be like profitable?
Well, profitable, it just depends on what analysts talk about, what it costs for a barrel to come out. You know, the average is $40 to $45 a barrel, the cost to extract. That was our slowdown in this last quarter is the price of the crude went down. So it got to the near levels of, you know, losing per barrel than making, right? But profitable, they're talking about, it's one of the largest finds in a long time. But I think they knew that already, but infrastructure and logistics weren't in place yet, but
well, the process of getting it out of the ground as well has changed as far as the ability.
The technology has increased, yeah, fracking. And
I guess what I was kind of thinking about is I use the word profitable, but I guess what I meant is this like a 5-year play, a 10-year play, a 50-year play, that type of thing.
At a minimum, I'll be conservative. I'm not an expert, but I do keep up. At a minimum, I'm looking at this basin will be 10 to 20 years active. We're in the middle of one of the biggest booms. Texas as a state, if it was a country, John, it's pretty kind of interesting. And, you know, I'm pretty proud of it too, because if Texas was a country, we produced third largest amount of oil in the whole world. It just as a state. So that's just what we have right now. And we already have, you know, proven reserves, which will last a while. So I think we'll be good for a while, John. But then we have to innovate. We have to innovate.
True. And that goes with all kinds of things, gas, technology, agriculture, just a whole variety of things. But Texas itself is one of those states. I mean, we have the Gulf where we have access to the ocean. Texas could exist itself as a self-sufficient country and just be very wealthy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that whole story of Texas always wants to recede. And you know what? I'm a guy that was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. And I have family and friends out here in Texas who come out here frequently and, you know, for the winter, because it was too damn cold up north, excuse me. But the thing is that it was just like a vacation spot. But coming out here, I'm like, you know what? I get it. It's a beautiful culture. It's they're proud of what they do, you know?
That's the thing. I love the people in Texas. I mean, it's amazing. And like I said, when we talked earlier, I told you I lived there for 3 decades.
Yeah, Dallas-Fort Worth, for sure.
The people are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. The summers kill me.
Yeah. I already told you about my training before I got here with the have to change my diet before I get a heart attack out here. Yeah, it's hot. You're right.
so hot. But when you take the winter's usually pretty mild, but the spring and the fall, although they're pretty short, are very spectacular.
Yeah, for sure.
Just, you know, you go out. And you wake up and maybe it's a little bit crisp and it's just getting just maybe a little bit warm by the end of the day and it cools back down and, you know, the blue skies and it's sunshiny. And then again, I do want to talk about the people because everywhere you go, you're going to find people that are great. You're going to find people that aren't great, but people in Texas are just in general friendly. How y'all doing? Mm-hmm. How can I help you? That kind of thing. I love it.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know how can I explain it. There's not even words. Like really, I'm a guy that talks a lot. And when I say I can't explain it and I can't find words, you know, John, I just leave it at that and say the people here are great. Very open market. The people that don't want to succeed here is just because they choose not to. It's beautiful because the blending of cultures and different foods and musics, it's awesome. If you come to Texas and you're bored and you don't succeed, it's just because you're not trying to, you know? It's the truth.
Yeah, there's phenomenal amount of opportunity there. You've got your business going, you're thinking about expanding, but in more of a general play without specifics as far as to those two things. Where do you want your business to go? Tell me a little bit about your plans. Tell me a little bit about your goals, your dreams, your ambitions.
Well, before I did this, you know, a couple of years back, I really took a break and I wrote a little article about it, my sabbatical, I suppose. And I analyzed myself and I think everybody should. It's something that's, you know, one of those come to Jesus meetings. And I said, okay, this is what I'm good at. This is what I'm bad at. You know, this is what I want to do and where I want to be in, say, 5 years. You know, everybody's is a 5-year plan. But realistically, I'm looking at, I work in exponentials. I work in helping people help me. You know, it's reciprocal. And, you know, 3 to 5 years is my actual plan. But I'd like to first start from the base, you know, In our industry, service is what sells anything after that. So I'm focusing on grabbing some of the top guys around the country or the world and make the base of my service exceptional first. And then hopefully pick up a line or two of machinery. We're talking about distributing CNC machines. I understand the sales. I've been involved with upstarts of different companies. But the thing is that if I do it right and I focus on service, I focus on customer service more than anything, I can expand. I have some sister companies in Mexico. We're actually incorporating in Mexico in this quarter. My wife, she's a Mexican and American citizen. She just did her dual citizenship. She was born here in Del Rio, Texas, but so she did the Mexican citizenship to go ahead and incorporate in Mexico Tech CNC within the next quarter. And the thing is that American companies find it much easier and safer, I guess, to work with an American company here in terms of the financials to take care of the service in Mexico. And you know what? Outsourcing is true. Outsourcing is happening. But if I'm an American company here in the U.S., I'm going to take care of my American companies in Mexico also. So that's kind of our outlook. We want to provide service, but also sell and distribute machinery because not because we're salesmen, but because we know what we're selling, if you get that, John.
Well, basically, it would allow you to help orchestrate the customer from start to finish, from the delivery of the machine, the setup of the machine, to maintenance of the machine. And so it'll help you keep that customer a productive with less downtime.
Correct. And right now, I don't sell machines in firsthand, such as I'm not the dealer, but I work with many dealers now. And I go in there, and if they sell the machine, I do exactly what you said. And I offer out of TechCNC a 1-year free preventive maintenance. So I throw that in just for the gratitude and keep the customer happy. But that's the plan. If I sell it and I'm representing a certain company, you know, we get the reciprocal service and business out of it. But more than anything, you know, we become experts in what we're doing exactly for that brand, as you know.
Good stuff. And I definitely wish you success on all of that.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that. Thank you. It's not easy. You know, it's a 24/7 job, and sometimes we got to sleep in between those hours, but it's what us crazy entrepreneurs do, you know?
Well, before we started the podcast, when we were talking earlier, you were telling me about some of those hours you were working each week, which was just insane.
Yeah, yeah. But it doesn't seem like work because, like I said, when you provide a service and the customer just damn, you know, he almost like hugs you and thanks you for what you did for him and writes you out a check. Sometimes, you know, most of my customers are 30 days, you know, I wait for them to pay me because it's not about the money, you know, like, all right, go ahead. Your machine's making money. All right. As long as the check's in the mail, that's fine.
Right.
But that's the thing that gives me that extra adrenaline when you see the customer happy, you know, his machine was down for a week. And, you know, some people lose contracts over this, John. You know, there's stipulations on contracts. You got to produce this many parts in this many time, and there's fines applied if you don't produce this many parts. And so I think it's more of a goodwill.
And so it's a lot more than the fact that the machine's down for 3 hours. There's a huge amount of leverage when that machine's down.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they're paying an operator X amount, you know, averaging somewhere from $20 to $30 an hour to stand around, you know. And it's not necessarily standing around. That sounds pretty bad. But the thing is that it's the truth. It's sometimes a cell that has 4 or 5 machines behind it. They're down. So you got 4 or 5 people just waiting because that machine's down. It's not producing the parts that go through to the other part. You know, that's very prevalent in the automotive industry. If you follow Tesla, it's great articles out there. And they had some problems with the robotic automation. They went to too much automation, and they ended up making a factory in their parking lot under a tent.
I heard about that.
Good old human muscle, and you know. Hey, you know what? I applied to SpaceX, and before I started my business, just to say I could work for them. And I respect them all, you know, totally. And I was pretty much almost hired for the position, but I declined. But I applied for them because I respect them. Elon Musk, there's a lot of negativity or articles against him, but I think he's crazy in a good way, put it that way.
I absolutely understand what you're saying there. And he's a polarizing individual, but he's yeah. also brilliant.
Oh yeah,
he is. I mean, to yeah. achieve the things that he's done, yeah. you're not an idiot. There's no way that you're going to be an idiot and achieve those things.
Yeah, and I totally understand when he says he slept at the factory and he worked all these hours, and it's what you got to do when you really believe in what's yours. It's a difference when you're an employee, John. You know, people, they're like, oh, I worked 20 hours overtime this week. That's 60 hours. Like, you know, they're like, oh, you know, that's a notch under my belt. But when you own a company and, you know, you don't brag about that stuff, you know, you don't even talk about it. And I've pushed myself towards exhaustion. I mean, I've pushed myself towards limits that, you know, I'm pretty religious, as I spoke to you earlier. You know, I pray to God and say, you know what, God, just help me out. And, you know, it's for the good, for the better good of everybody. And we push ourselves to our limits, and sometimes, you know, we find another limit. And it's just like when you're out there, you're not chasing money. You're chasing your dream, your goals. You know, it's greater, because my business, as it grows, I'm able to employ people, and, you know, they have families and kids, and, you know, I want them to be good too. And it's just great. Like, that's a way that a business can give back. And I just wish a lot more businesses here would, I guess, instead of sending work outside of the country, stay here. And there's money to be made, but I think the investors are the people that make these other corporations outsource, you know, and lay off people and whatnot.
I'm a real big supporter of American made and keeping everything that we can being manufactured here. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is possible to get things made cheaper overseas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think that we're doing ourselves a disservice as a country.
Oh yeah, we are, John. When I was in India, I did a lot of research on that itself. It was 2004, 2005 when I was out there. And, you know, I got out there, somebody called me from California. They found out I was pretty good at what I did. And I agreed, and hesitantly, because I said, well, you know, I feel like a traitor because this company from California went out to India to manufacture. But at the same token, I said, if I don't do it, somebody else will. So let me take this advantage of opportunity to learn. But what I found out was that you lose a lot of the intellect, a lot of the innovations. And if you see China and all these other countries that have taken on our work, they're innovating, they're producing, because what happens is there's stuff that's being made now that can be made better. But if you're not making it, you can't improve it. You understand?
Right.
So you're absolutely right. Because if we have it here in our country, we keep it here, we improve upon it, you know, and all we're doing now, it's like the Trump situation with the trade. I respect that a lot, but the thing is, we gave it all to them. It's kind of like now we're kind of working backwards towards that, because it's like, well, we wanted to just look at the bottom line, but now we're finding out they're stealing our ideas, stealing our patents, stealing our this. Right. But you know what? They're not stealing it. We gave it to them. Yeah.
There's both. We absolutely have given it to them, but they've also, there's some nefarious characters out there.
No, you're right. No, I'm with you.
But we've made it easier for them.
Yeah, no, you're right. But when you give them the process and the prints, documentation, the know-how, you gave it to them, John. You see, even here now myself,
right?
I worked for different corporations that I was doing repair on equipment down to the board level, down to diodes and capacitors. And I had prints on this board, right. This without this capacitor at this rating, it ain't going to work or whatnot. So that's intellect know-how. That's very, very confidential mm-hmm. information. Now, you're sending all this technology to China and India and all these other countries. You got to send them that stuff, John.
They can't build it without it.
Dumb people. They're reverse engineering, and all of a sudden, okay, well, they did it this way. You know what? I'll do it better, or I'll do it my way. So that's what I refer to. Like, yeah, we didn't give it to them per se, but we gave it to them at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Sure. And we all take advantage of knowledge. Okay, not all, but that's what we do, is we take advantage of knowledge that we learn this and we learn this, and somebody gives us a little bit mm-hmm. of this. And if we are the type of person that has that drive, for instance, off the wall example I'm going to make mm-hmm. up right here. If I went to work for a guy that painted houses mm-hmm. and I spent time with him, and he taught me how to get a really smooth finish on the baseboards. And here's how to be real efficient with the paint, that you get good coverage, but you have a low amount of loss, and now you're going to be more profitable. Yep. I can see all those techniques, and I'm going to be like, I'm going to go start my own.
There you go.
And that happens a lot. But if he treats me really well and teaches me, and he makes me feel like I'm a part of that company, I'll be like, you know what? He doesn't make it painful for me. It's a really great place to work. I'm just going to stay here, and we're going to work as a great team. Mm-hmm. And so the companies that make it difficult for people and make their lives as an employee not pleasant, and they still give that employee access to information, that employee is motivated to go off and make his life better. And now he has the ability to do that.
Yeah. And John, going back to that, as you know, talking about employer-employee relations, here at Tech CNC, what we strive to make is an employee-owned company or corporation. Basically saying that you work for us, you're part of the company. And, you know, all my new hires that I'm bringing up for, you know, future management positions, I'm like, all right, buddy, you're going to train 3, 4, 5 guys underneath you. And those guys are going to be basically your profit centers. So I give my employees, you know, a salary, but with the vision and the future of saying, you know what, you have 3, 4 guys that you train and they make X amount of revenue for this company. I believe that you're entitled to a percentage of that, you know, because they built and helped build my company. So I help build people to build others. And if we can do that, you know, right. If everybody felt that way, I think it'd be great, because some people are not meant to be entrepreneurs. Like you said, John, some people are smart enough to go out there and say, you know what, I'm going to risk it. And you know, I'm going to get a loan and go out there and eat peanut butter jelly sandwiches every night. You know, but the thing is that some people are just employees, but if they're good employees that respect and are loyal to the company, I'm a reward them, you know. I don't want them to go anywhere.
Right.
And I want them to feel safe, you know, secure.
Well, there's some people that they would rather work for themselves and eat peanut butter jelly sandwiches versus making more money working for a company.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
they just have to have that independence.
Yeah. And I did that. You know, I bit the bullet. You know, I have a beautiful wife and 4 kids. I have my responsibilities. And I took the leap and said, you know what, I could work for all the big names, you know, 6-figure salaries. But I took the leap because I said, I already did it for everybody else. Why can't I do it for me? And I didn't do it for the money. I did it for exactly what you said, you know, the freedom. And what I do, I believe I'm innovating my industry in that way, because my focus is strictly service and be a multifaceted company, not just dealing with one type of equipment. But hopefully I grow into be able to grab some lines. Right now I do represent a couple lines, you know, for products, you know, specifically product. And you know, that's just kind of the baby steps. I'm representing a couple lines for the peripherals, which are equipment that goes on these machines. And that's what we call baby steps. You know, I just want to represent those. And you know, hopefully I train all my guys and they're all on board, but I'm out there in the field with them. You know, a leader can't lead by sitting on a table. You know, I lead by being right next to them, rubbing shoulders and getting dirty with them, you know?
Right.
That's where the blue
That's great.
That's where the blue collar comes in. John, we're talking about that. You know, it's
yes, we were.
Yeah, it's as high tech and as all this and that programming and logic and software and computers that we're involved with. Now, sometimes I'm in there and I'll come out of a machine and take, you know, have to wear two different Tyvek suits because of the oil and grease. I actually tagged on my post on LinkedIn, Mike Rowe works dirty jobs. And I'd like to have him come out here with us one day on a preventive maintenance on a machine. It's gruesome stuff, but like I say, kids, we still at least make enough money to buy us a little bit of soap, you know? But the blue collar, I could be in an office. I was with other companies all year and sit down and help people over the phone and, you know, wear my nice little shirt and slacks to work. But the field is something else. It's like what you said earlier, running around, having the freedom. But blue collar all the way, man. Yeah.
This is a great segue that you brought up. And that's the idea of doing this kind of work and doing this as a career. What is the job prospects of if you decide that you wanted to get into a career as repairing CNC machines or programming them? How's that looking?
Well, John, I actually, you said what I want to do in the future. Part of my goals and aspirations is to actually have a training course, trying to work out their accreditation and part of the local technical colleges here. And this industry is in strong need of technicians and engineers. You can Google right now, you know, if anybody listens to the podcast, Google right now, field service engineer, CNC field service engineer. You know, I'm the owner of my company. Well, excuse me, my wife is, but I still get requests because I contract some of my employees for on-site work. So I do have it open for, say, hire, but I get a bunch of different headhunters, maybe 3 or 4 a day, offering me a position, you know, and
that's pretty phenomenal.
And this industry is just that because these kids are going into school for business or for, all the typical jobs that are, they look all pretty and Hollywoodish and, you know, it's not the manufacturing factory settings that people desire. I mean, that's what people think that, oh, I don't want to go to a factory. But the thing is that these careers are well paid. I'm going to tell you right now that on average, a well educated, trained mechatronics student, I'll hire him for $60,000 starting right now. You know, want somebody that wants to
that's
learn.
That's not bad. Not bad at all.
What, you know, somebody that wants to learn right now. Somebody that's trained, the top techs that I have, they could be pulling $120,000, $130,000 a year. And, you know, these are not. These
that's
are,
pretty freaking awesome.
Yeah, these are not careers that are like, you know, your $80,000 accountant job at some firm that you want to look nice when you get in there with a nice plaid shirt and slacks and come out nice and pretty. You know, we'll take some hits. You know, you'll come out greasy, you'll come out. But the thing is, the money's right.
Right.
But it's not about the money. You got to love what you're doing, man. It's the challenge.
Sure.
When you go into a job and you walked in and 4 or 5 of their guys tried to figure it out and they couldn't. And yeah, you come out like a champ. But yeah, we get defeated sometimes. You know, we strike out too. I mean, it's. We don't know everything, as I said, John. We're still students in life.
Absolutely. So what does it take to get trained? Like, let's say somebody's thinking about doing this. Okay, let's have a little bit more realistic situation. Somebody's already graduated high school. They're scrambling around and they're mm-hmm. like, how could I get into doing this? What kind of training, what kind of steps would they have to take to be able to get a career as a CNC repair guy?
Right now, I'm advertising entry-level positions. An entry-level would be a high school guy that has mechanical aptitude and electrical aptitude. But at the same time, the minimum that I ask is take at least one electrical course, which would include your AC, that's alternate current, and DC, which is direct current electronics theory, okay, and fundamentals. And what I say is, do like what we did before. You know, you work and go to school at the same time. That's the best way to learn. TechCNC will actually pay for your education. You know, there's some stipulations involved with that, but if you really want to make a career and grow, our company will help you because we understand that you're going to help us.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, no, that's how I look at it because
I salute you for that.
Well, thank you. It's just something that we have to do because you got to help each other at the same time. What happens is that, you know, there's a high school kid that works on his car. Like I said, that's how I came out, working on cars and electronics. And my dad said, hey, buddy, you got to do something in school. So yeah, I had to go do something in school. So I chose what kind of I had aptitude for and paid pretty well. And what we do is, as an entry level, I could get a kid to do preventive maintenance, which means just go out there, change the oils and do this and do the checks. And as you get more familiarized with the machines and you go to school and get more familiarized with electronics and mechanical bearings, grades, as you talked earlier about bearings, as you know, there's a lot involved, how much grease you put in them, the revolutions per minute involved, but all this stuff comes by itself, but we're willing to train and shadow and come along and work with us. You know, it's really, if anybody out there or any parents listening, you know, if you have a good kid, I have a couple kids that are actually doing majors for airplane mechanics, which is a very volatile industry. It goes up and down fast, just like the plane. I got a couple kids that are getting their engineering on that, and I'm hiring them on because they see the writing on the wall already before they're even finishing school. But I believe that anybody can come out here and teach them. Even operators running machines now are the best.
When you say operators running the machines, you're talking about they may not have the knowledge of how to repair them, but they have a knowledge of how to use it. So it translates very well to repair.
Yes, because you see, we spoke earlier about my inception into this industry was running machines. And once you know how to make product out of it and you understand the mechanical and electrical aspects of that machine, troubleshooting becomes much easier. It feels good when a customer calls you and says, hey, I have chatter on my part, which means the finish is not very smooth. But then you look at their program, you look at their feeds and speeds, and you look at their tooling. You know, I came out of cutting tools, so I understand rake angles and helix angles. So application on the product, operating of the machine. And then when you start learning about how that machine was built, you're like that's the perfect trilogy there because you know the machine, you know the theory, and you know the product. You could discern any troubleshooting or any root cause because of either application or mechanical or electrical errors, you know?
Right.
So operators, I love them, man, because they know what we call what is the feel of the machine. If the feel of the machine, you could grab a machine and it doesn't feel good. It's a certain, you know, certain
like they just sense that maybe there's a little bit of vibration that shouldn't be there or it's moving sluggish, that kind of thing.
Correct. Exactly, John. It's like the machine whisperer. Right.
Well, you know, it sounds like you've got some good stuff going on there. And I like the fact that, you know, you're providing opportunities for people. You're helping. You're not just providing the opportunities. You're helping them take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels good. It feels good, John.
So let's go ahead. One more topic that we'll take a little turn into. We've talked about your business. We've talked about how you've gotten here. We've talked about some of those things. But on a more personal note, what are some things that you're just passionate about as you, as Manny?
All of this, at the end of the day, becomes the sharing, you know, of knowledge. I started a book. I wrote about 66 pages. And I stopped writing when I really got into this business hardcore for the reason being that I think the best pages in that book are being made right now, you know? I made a Facebook page called Anecdotes for Living. Anecdotes are short stories, right? That's not the title of my book. The title of the book are short stories, are just little anecdotal stories of situations that we've kind of just talked about now, you know, in life and business. But more than anything, for me, is being able to live and be happy with life. People talk about the pursuit of happiness. And during that conversation one day with a gentleman, I brought up my own little, what I quote myself on now is, it's not the pursuit of happiness. It's to have a pursuit equals the happiness. Do you understand?
I do.
If you don't need an alarm clock in the morning to wake up,
the doing is enough.
That's it. That's it. You know, I know this world rotates and revolves around money, but money is not the object, you know. That comes by itself. If what you're doing as a service, you're providing a solution, you're helping others, which could be your customer and your employees at the same time, you know. I love it when my employees' families, you know, they thank me and they say all these things to me that are just really the truth. It's too much for me to even, you know, take, because I don't expect anything from them. You know, it's vice versa. Like, they need to understand, I'm very grateful for them to be part of my team and believe in my vision, because yeah, I'm a young guy. Well, I'm 40, I'll be 40 this year, but you know, my vision is big. I'm out there turning wrenches and developing the business. Sometimes, you know, I dress up and look pretty. Sometimes I look like I just fell out of a truck, you know? And that's me. It's just, life is not around the business. None of that. Like, that's business talk. But I believe, I'm religious, you know, our God gives us all gifts. Some people are thinking, what's my gift? You know, like, what's my gift to the world? But this is my gift to the world. You know, if me helping companies succeed and keep them going and keep their employees employed, that's, I guess, my biggest reward is seeing that. So that's who Manny is.
Excellent.
You know?
Well, Manny, we've covered a number of things. And before we get out of here, anything else that is coming to your mind that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to say? The floor is yours.
You know what? If there's anybody out there listening and really loves manufacturing, but wants this to become something good and get another jump start like it was back in the day in the 60s and 70s when everything was hustling and bustling and getting a factory job was a thing to do after high school. You know, let's link up, because I'd like to invest into a training facility to get these kids, you know, the future of our industry, trained. And even if they come from all over the world, all over the country, such as, you know, Titan.
Right.
Out of Titan Gilroy, out of Titan CNC. What he does for manufacturing is great. You know, I had the pleasure to meet him while I was doing a contract in IMTS in Chicago this year. Man, he's larger than life. I mean, I'm a small guy, but when I saw him, I'm like,
He is a big guy.
Wow, he is a giant. But his heart is bigger than anything, man. You know, to make, I said earlier, my little analogy here, like Trump says, right? But for me, it's, let's make manufacturing great again. Because we're a country that has everything possible. And if we don't, we're a country that's resilient and innovative enough to make it happen, you know? And I just want to be part of manufacturing in the future. Like, I'm young yet. And once I get my engine rolling here, I want to put time aside to actually invest into others and kids. And, you know, we need to have that base of technicians, engineers, and programmers and operators out there, because we cannot be a sustainable country if we're not making anything. And if there's nobody to make it, we're not going to sustain ourselves. We're going to have to outsource. And you know what? That's going to be an uphill battle if we don't start now. That's pretty much in the closing there, John.
Excellent. In the show notes, I'll put links so people can connect to you. Manny, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so glad you reached out to me. This has been a great episode. I've learned a lot of good thoughts. I like what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that, John. But you know what? Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me some time to at least put out there who we are, but more than anything, who we are as a country, you know, who we are as a manufacturing powerhouse and a country of intellect and innovation and a country that if we all get together and embrace who we are and what we have here. And you know what? We'll keep on making America great again, you know?
Thank you so much, Manny.
All right, sir. You have a good one. Thanks for having me.
Today's trivia question is, what year did CNC machines become available? Our next guest on Blue Collar Voices is Chris Goodry. Chris works with Google AdWords, and the main focus of discussion is how Google AdWords can help your blue collar business. Here is a snippet from our conversation.
I was not good at using a computer. I wasn't a fan of having a cell phone, but I had to have one. And, you know, it's just kind of how it started. And I was in a strip center, and the restaurant next to me was like, man, you got a lot of people coming in and out, you know? And he's like, what are you doing? So I showed him, you know, ran a little campaign for him. It helped. The barber down the way, you know, he liked it because people come in and out of my place and see his place. And I told him about it. Then I started teaching Google Ads at the chamber just because I was just sharing with other business owners what worked. I closed that business down in 07, at the end of 07, whenever people weren't moving as often because I was selling moving boxes. And then started working for some of the largest internet marketing companies in America. I worked for three or four of them in different departments, learned all about the big business of internet marketing, worked for...
Hey guys, before you go, two things. The first is, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. I realize this is an older podcast, but I'm updating this podcast in November 2019 for the announcement of an upcoming road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and or video. Please check out the website for more information. I'd love to hear from you. Email me at johnc@bluecollarvoices.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Thanks all. Looking forward to hearing from you. Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.